Are you tired of using subpar fertilizer that don't give your crops the boost they need? Look no further than Irish Shite, the all-natural and sustainable solution for your farm. Made from the finest blend of Irish animal waste, Irish Shite provides essential nutrients for your crops to thrive. And it's not just good for your crops, it's also good for your skin. With Irish Shite, you'll look 10 years younger. So why settle for less? Choose Irish Shite. It's made right here in Ireland. And be sure to tell your friends and fellow farmers about the power of Irish manure. This message has been brought to you by the Irish Shite Association, the natural choice for a sustainable farm.
What was the guy from Fox? Bill something. The guy that, that was...
Fox?
No, Bill something. The Irish guy, the Irish-American guy.
What are you talking about, Fox? What's Fox?
Fox, the American, Fox News, the American fucking thing.
Oh, Bill...
The propaganda
Bill
thing.
Shithead.
Bill Shithead. So when Bill Shithead was going like, fuck it, we'll do it live.
Is not Carlson Tucker or something like that, was it?
No. Tucker Carlson, that's the guy that looks like he's always like shat his pants and... And he doesn't know what he's going to do next. He doesn't know how he's going to sort of get out of the situation.
I have a strange sensation in my underwear right now, and I'm not sure how I feel about this.
I'll use small words that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
What did you say?
You are a sad, strange little man.
Don't call me stupid.
Hello, and welcome to The Best Bits, a movie podcast where each week we pick our favourite scenes from randomly selected, weirdly specific themes. This is your co-host Will, a writer of three films plus a Christmas special, and I am joined once again by my co-host and writer of one and a bit films.
Hello, Will. How are you?
Of Kevin, how are you? I'm very good. You just spoke over me. You rude.
I don't
you
want
to cut the scene again.
I don't want you to keep telling people I've only done one film.
Sorry.
It's getting embarrassing.
God damn it, Kevin. Great, write more movies. How are you? Kevin, write more movies and get them produced and have them in theatres like in the next 2 weeks, please, if you don't mind.
I prefer writing deleted scenes, to be honest.
Completely deleted scenes. Kevin, this week I have been tasked with the challenge of coming up with my best deleted scenes. And let me tell you, I discovered something amazing. Do you want to know what it is?
Okay. Well, yes. That's the whole point of the podcast.
This is the bit of knowledge that's going to blow your mind. And what I learned is that every film has a deleted scene. Every fucking film has a deleted scene, right?
We're writers. Writers could tell you that.
Yeah, I know. And every film we've written has deleted scenes, you know, of course. So every film has deleted scenes. So the task of going and figuring out what in the hell, you know, my best deleted scenes would be is it's like shuffling through the debris, the discarded snippets of people's efforts.
And you know what's different about this episode compared to all the other episodes is that for the first time I know what your pick is. Because you told everybody in the group chat, of which I'm a member.
Shut
you asked
Kevin.
People for confirmation.
Shut up.
So I'm going to have to pretend that this is all brand new information.
It's called acting, Kevin, lad. No wonder you didn't become an actor. If you could just keep your trap shut. Oh, yeah.
I tell you what,
I did
acting once. I did, an acting course. Yeah, for 6 weeks I did an acting academy thing. And I loved it. I loved it for one reason, right? You know, when you go to the gym and you come out of the gym and you feel like, you feel sort of relaxed. You feel like you've gotten all this adrenaline out of your system. When you did like this, when I did this acting course, purely out of complete boredom, and I felt like maybe I should learn how to deliver a line that somebody else has written and see what that feels like if I'm going to be writing lines for other people. But mm-hmm. I felt like that every week it was total and utter like humiliation and embarrassment. But then I walked out of the studio every afternoon on Saturday, and I just felt like light. I felt like that was humiliating and really embarrassing, and it did not matter. It was absolutely fine. That's so amazing. I found it really sort of healthy, like mentally, like it gave me such clarity. Sorry, Will, we can cut this. It can be another deleted scene.
Kevin, deleted scenes, Jesus. Kevin. Deleted scenes, that's what we're here to talk about.
Can I tell you what my pick is to kick this off?
Shit, will that help? Do it. Yeah, go on.
When we have the wheel, right, and we spin it, there are certain topics mm-hmm. that both of us really want, and I really wanted this one because, and it's probably good that I didn't get it, because I just talked about, on special effects, the first film that my pick mm-hmm. is coming from. So I felt like, oh, that worked out all right, because I would have just been hammering home this franchise again. But my pick is not so much a deleted scene, but it's a restored scene in an alternate cut, and it precedes Zack Snyder's Justice League, and it's from Richard Donner's Superman 2, his cut.
Oh, yeah.
Superman 2, the adventure continues.
And it's the scene that was originally, when they were shooting Superman and Superman 2, they did them back to back, and they got about 70% of the way through Superman 2, and they pulled the plug and decided to focus on getting the first movie done so they could have it out at Christmas. The Salkind producers did that. And mm-hmm. so everybody broke, and they left the Superman 2 with 30% to go, and they were going to come back and they were going to figure out a new ending and what have you. And the scene that I would have chosen for best deleted scene is from an audition footage that they put back into the alternate Donner cut that they were intending to shoot, but they never got around to shooting it. But they still have that audition footage. And it's the scene where Lois Lane basically figures out that Clark Kent is Superman by shooting him with a gun that has a blank in it.
Thousands of children potentially falling off something lethal all around the world. Would Superman be in Niagara Falls today? Why wouldn't he be in the Grand Canyon?
Why don't you ask the child's family? I'm sure they would know.
And why is it always when I'm with you until Superman appears? And then you seem to disappear. Well, very conveniently, it seems to me.
I'm not for hot dogs. Repeat, take your the one.
Uh-huh. And when Superman appeared, I looked over at that hot dog stand and you were gone. You weren't there.
I was...
Nowhere.
I can't help it if I had to go to the...
You are Superman, aren't you?
Lois, look, we've been through these hallucinations of yours before. Can't you see what you almost did? Throwing yourself off a building 30 stories high? Can't you see what a tragic mistake you almost made?
I made a mistake. I made a mistake because I risked my life instead of yours.
Lois, don't be insane.
And don't fall down, because you're just going to have to get up again.
Lois, now don't be crazy now. Lois!
And it's not just like a cracking fucking scene, but it's one of those scenes that is so good that it just hurts me that they never actually did it properly. And that they went with the version that's in Superman 2, which has Clark Kent tripping over a pink bearskin rug and putting his hand into the fire and it not burning him. And that's the version that they use, taking away sort of the cleverness and the wit and the banter of Lois and Clark, where... she's tricking him into revealing that he's Clark Kent by shooting him.
You realize, of course, if you'd been wrong, Clark Kent would have been killed.
With a blank? Gotcha.
I saw, that is so good. That is such great writing. And the Salkinds, motherfuckers, they insisted that with Richard Lester taking over from Richard Donner, that he shoot his own version in order to get at least 50% of his take on the film in there, so that he could get credit. And that's why we have the inferior Superman 2. But that would be my pick.
That is actually a fantastic pick. Because that scene, everything about that scene is great. That build-up to, you know, it's just a scene in it's a scene in isolation that works from the very beginning to the reveal. It's like a little short film. And
yeah. Because it goes, it flies in the face of the whole thing of, like, why doesn't she know that Clark Kent is Superman? And so they open the sequel with her immediately guessing that he is Superman by drawing Clark Kent's hat and glasses on a picture of Superman filling in a suit. Mm-hmm. And she's so convinced that she's figured out that Clark is Superman. This is the very first scene of the sequel that she throws herself out of the window. And so when it comes around to this version, she's like, I made one mistake. I risked my life instead of risking yours. And that's the payoff to it. And it's just such great writing from Tom Mankiewicz that it's such a shame that it got cut. But thank God for the Donner cut, because that was like Christmas for me, seeing those other versions of the scenes that are so much better than what we got.
That entire alternate cut is such an interesting... if you haven't seen them, seek them out. They're a real treat and a real surprise when you actually see what Donner had in mind. And
it doesn't particularly work though as like a film, because have to repurpose the footage. But I guess, you know, when we're going to be talking about deleted scenes, we're going to be talking about director's cuts, and I think that is one of those strange middling director's cuts, in that it's more like an oddity than an actual film. But yeah, it's definitely worth watching.
Definitely. And that's a good segue, because I briefly wanted to touch on director's cuts. And the reason being is because, you know, every film has got deleted scenes. And what has happened in recent decades is that we've seen scenes be directors get a second take at these, where they get to reinstate some of those scenes that were deleted and kind of like to fill out the film. So, these scenes mightn't, for me, be... I could classify them as like best deleted scene, because all they really might do is just give an extra beat of a character, just basically change the pacing of a film, where it's a kind of almost an invisible addition, an invisible kind of like enhancement to the original cut. And there have been several of those, and the most recent film, and I know we've already brought it up in the podcast, is definitely Kingdom of Heaven.
Be without fear in the face of your enemies. Safeguard the helpless, even if it leads to your death. That is your oath. Rise a knight! Rise a knight!
The director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven improves that film upon the theatrical cut, where it's the pacing of it feels right, the characters' motivations feels right, you feel it's a film that has a particularly devastating tragedy at its heart, which I think gets just rushed through in the theatrical cut. And it's all little snips, it's all little additions.
Yeah, it's not so much deleted scenes, it's like there are the context within scenes gets chopped down for the theatrical cut.
Yeah.
But Ridley Scott has, he must have more director's cuts than any other director out there.
Sure, look at Blade Runner alone.
What is it, 7 or something like that?
You can pick your poison for that one. Which one's the original cut or the last one, I don't know.
Yeah, but isn't the unicorn, it changes everything about that film. And that's an addition, isn't it? So.
It is, yeah.
Well, Ridley, for me, I think that everyone should, if you've got the opportunity to watch a Ridley Scott film and there is a director's cut, always go for the director's cut, because the film is just, it works so much better, except in one instance, and it's the director's cut of Alien, I think it slows the film down and it's baggier, and I don't think it improves the film. So, but all his other director cuts, I think, are well worth choosing over the theatrical cuts.
Yeah, and I'd agree with you that. I think you're right on that one. It's just, there's a very fine line. you know, it's all about pacing, isn't it? It's all about the pacing of the story.
Yeah.
Another film that just popped into my head that kind of had an unofficial, well, it was a director's cut, but they never called it a director's cut. They called it a special edition, was E.T. And E.T. has...
No.
But what I'm talking
Delete
about is...
that version.
Oh, exactly. Because that's a version where they inserted a scene, an extra scene of E.T. and Elliot kind of like getting to know each other, where E.T.'s in the bathtub and all that sort of stuff. And what it does is all of a sudden...
CG E.T.
There was like one or two shots of CG E.T., but it basically, it completely just slows down the pace of the second half of that film, really just grinds it to a halt, because we kind of see a repetition of some of the stuff of Elliot playing, you know, just mitching off school and you know, it basically all the information we got in the scene had already been established earlier on, and it wasn't
the forward momentum just stops, doesn't it?
Exactly. So it's a very delicate balance, isn't it?
Mm. I think that Spielberg has gone back on that, where he doesn't... maybe we talked about this on the podcast already, but I feel like he has said that the special edition of E.T. was a mistake. So in that instance, that director's cut, which I suppose, yeah, he didn't really call it a director's cut, but in that instance, he doesn't stand by that as being the definitive E.T. He thinks that you should still go back and watch the original. So he would prefer those deleted scenes to remain deleted scenes.
Yeah, I think, yeah, the version they had in the theatrical was just the right version. And versus, like, you know, just recalling the most recent example, like, you know, like Kingdom of Heaven. I never felt it getting baggy. I never felt the story was being slowed down as a consequence of these additional scenes or whatever. Director's cut that I just want to bring up that I highly recommend is, you know, one for me that I love is Das Boot.
Isn't Uvans? Genau Uvans.
You know, it's Wolfgang Petersen's World
War II. I've only seen the director's cut, so I don't know what they cut to do the original release. So, because I saw that on DVD,
there's a couple of interesting cuts. There was an original cut which is about 2 hours long. It still had all of the same beats, but it was just a bit snappier and shorter, really. But then for the British on BBC, they re-released it as a miniseries and actually made it like 6 hours. It was 4 hour thing, a miniseries, and really padded out and broke it up into an episodic story, and it still worked. But then they, for the director's cut, they kind of found the middle house where they came up with a version that was about 2.5 hours long. I might be writing that. But in what they've just added to it is a lot more characterization, a lot more time spent with the members of the crew. But the thing about it is what's essential is that the sense of tension is never dissipated in that film. There's always this sense of tension down in the U-boat. And in whichever version you watch, you will get the same experience. But I think they, from what I've read, this miniseries is excellent. You know, if you can ever find that, it's excellent. But I would highly recommend the director's cut. It's just a cracking film.
See, because I
love it.
You can almost undercut yourself by putting in deleted scenes. Like the one that is coming to my head as we're talking though is the opening to Escape from New York.
New York, 1997. The entire city is a walled maximum security prison.
That's a very linear film where you're meeting Snake Plissken and you're just learning him through his behavior rather than his backstory, which I personally, as a writer, I always prefer that, to sort of like tell you who the people are by how they're moving through the world in the present as we're watching them, rather than flashbacks or beginning too early in the story. But the deleted scene from Escape from New York was the bank robbery, where you get to see Snake rob a bank, go back for his partner, and then get captured. and that's how he gets brought into the story. And I feel that that diminishes him a little bit. It's cool to see, to sort of see him like engaged in something that we've not seen before, or I'd not seen before. But then when you realise what it does for the character, it just sort of makes him smaller and less iconic and more sort of like, oh, he was just a shit bank robber, rather than him being this ultimate badass whose reputation precedes him. And yeah, so they were right to cut that deleted scene, I think. Although it's worth watching because it's so fun, and it's always fun to see peak era Carpenter and Kurt Russell working together.
Hey, what's wrong, Snake?
Somebody's here.
Oh, come on, man. What are you worried about? We made it, baby!
And it's a, they're kind of that's the great thing about deleted scenes, is that if you have the DVD or whatever, you can seek them out and you get like additional insights into the character. They're like little vignettes of like, oh, I'm so glad I have this, but I'm so glad it's kind of separate to the film, so it doesn't despoil the pacing or the rhythm of the film. But you're kind of glad you experienced it. Oh, where I want to take you is, right, I was looking back in time. I wanted to see if I could find old deleted scenes, and they're quite hard to come by from older classic films. But the oldest one that I found, you know, there's ones from Metropolis and stuff like that, but I found a really cool one that I actually thought was actually a really interesting one. And there's a deleted scene from The Wizard of Oz.
Follow the yellow brick road, follow the yellow brick road, follow the yellow brick road.
And it's an 8-minute musical number called The Jitterbug, and the actual music and all survives, but the only footage that's remaining of it is like kind of like behind the scenes, like 8mm footage that they've kind of like tried to match up with the actual vocal recording, like, you know. And you can see it's Dorothy and the lion, the Tin Man, and they end up kind of getting trapped by these, not trapped, kind of like lured in by these strange talking trees and all that sort of jazz. And they're doing a jitterbug number and jitterbug dance. And it's actually, it was a real delight because the number is actually kind of catchy. And they probably cut it just because pacing. I'd imagine it's just like, oh yeah, we need to kind of move along with things now. But it was so intriguing to find it. Like, you know, I was like going, Jesus, this whole 8-minute chunk of The Wizard of Oz that was just, has never been seen. And seeing the old grainy footage of it is actually quite cool. So it's actually worth looking on YouTube as well if you haven't seen it.
Is that hiding in the treetops? Is that rascal, the jitterbug? Should you catch?
Also, Orson Welles has got like a whole career of like deleted scenes, doesn't he? With like the Magnificent Ambersons and deleted career. Oh, terrible. Oh. How do you survive that? That would crush you. Yeah,
you have to drink and eat a lot. I see. That's what you end up doing. You just end up taking
proper
to the
order.
Sauce. Yeah, just going, F it. I am just going on the lash. And if someone will give me a job, great. I'll advertise what? Champagne? Okay.
I'll be Optimus Prime. Fuck it.
Action awesome, please.
Just do anything?
No, it's sorry, cut. You're rolling. 102, take two.
Ah, the French champagne has always been celebrated for its excellence. There is a California champagne by Paul Masson.
So I'm going to go through. I've basically got this list of 10, right? And I've gone through a couple already. But I found a cool little deleted scene from The Goonies.
You guys, just what if this map could lead to One-Eyed Willie's rich stuff?
I'm setting booby traps.
You mean booby traps?
That's what I said, booby traps.
And it's not the one you're thinking of.
It's not the octopus.
No, not the octopus. Right, because, you know, at the end of Goonies, I always remember hearing
is
Chunk
the
when they
scene?
Get rescued. No, sex scene? What sex scene? I don't remember a sex scene. Hello, what's going on?
It's where all the Goonies basically They lose their virginity in the cave together.
Right, no, you're thinking
sorry,
of
that's
it.
The ending of the It.
Yeah, that's what you're thinking of. No, it's a scene, because there is an octopus scene, and that's what makes it, because I always thought, when I watched that when I was a kid, when Chunk at the end is like describing to the parents, and there was a pirate ship, and there was bad guys, and there was a giant octopus, and I went, oh, it's just Chunk making up stories again.
Yeah,
but in actual fact, there was an octopus scene, and I've watched that, and it's, I understand why it was cut. It's awful. It's terrible. The octopus just didn't work. It looks awful. And Data defeats it by putting a tape recorder with music playing in his mouth. And it was just really bad. But the scene I actually really liked that was cut, and again, I can probably understand why it was cut, was just before, after the kids find this map that leads them to One-Eyed Willy's treasure. They, you know, in
this
the film,
in
they
the
kind of get on their bikes and they're gone. Just after the house, right? So what happens is they go, before they go to the restaurant,
cabin.
They actually they stop at a shop.
Yay! I'll tell you what, you go over there and take any three candy bars you want.
Boy!
Huh? Any
three of those
candy bars.
$4.99 in cash. No, $5 in cash.
How about two candy bars, a tablet, the Crayolas, and a $1.50 in cash?
And it's there that we see, because I watched it recently with the kids.
Oh, I remember this.
And I always, do you know the scene I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. And it's actually where we see Mikey, he's got the map and he finds a local tourist map.
Cannon Beach. Wait a second. This looks almost identical. The X. Where's the X? The X is here. Hang on. Wait a minute. Oh my god, I know these rocks. I know where this is. Guys, check it out. I know how to get here. This is Astoria. This is where the rich stuff's buried. Come on, guys. We can go there. We can get the rich stuff.
Trickler. And in my head, as an adult watching it now, I kind of did feel the logic disjoint of, hang on a second, Mikey just got the map and he just automatically knew where to go. And that is one element that I thought was kind of fun. But also, there's a funny bit where Chunk is in the freezer and he's literally opening the lids of ice cream and he's just taking bites out of ice creams and closing the lids back in again. It's disgusting. But we have the bully guy come in, and the bully kind of like, starts bullying. Surprise, surprise. But I can see why he was cut, because it was might have slowed down them getting out onto the road. But the thing they sacrificed...
I also remember it being, they were manic. They were all like talking at once, as they do throughout nearly the whole film. But I remember thinking, oh, this probably felt like it was just one sort of like chaotic scene too many with all the kids.
Yeah, that's it. That's probably it, you know. But in my head, it resolves a kind of an issue I have of them finding the treasure, you know, putting the dots together too easily about the map and the quest that they're going on. And it was simply when Mikey found the little local map, and I went, oh, that gives me a little bit of ease in my head. there's a bit of logic going on here.
The screenwriter brain it's a fun scene. Sated by that.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. But I still think it's a fun scene. I still think there's a lot of good characterization, and there's, but maybe it's repetitive. Another one that I liked was the one from Kill Bill Volume 2.
One ticket to Tokyo, please. One way.
That woman deserves her revenge. And we deserve to die.
No kidding, I heard it was kind of hard.
There was an amazing deleted scene from the script that got cut where... oh, it was so cool to read where it took place in the States, and it was the bride having an encounter with, I think it was Yuki? Is it Yuki or Yukio? Oh, God, I can't remember her name though. But I think it was, she had a twin sister. The twin sister, after she had killed the sort of Orenishi's henchwoman, her twin sister came for the bride when she was in the States, and it took place in the suburbs, and it was this huge, like, gunfight. So all the different fights were sort of, like, particular, and they were using different weapons, and this was basically, like, heat. It was just a complete shootout where the bride was basically leaping walls and going through swimming pools and through people's houses, engaging this shootout with the sister, and it ended up with her, the bride, having killed her, hiding out in a treehouse and a night nurse character coming and basically patching her up. And it was a cool sort of like interstitial action sequence that it got lost when they when they split the films in two. But yeah, that's a deleted scene that comes to mind to me when I think of Kill Bill.
That sounds great. It really does. The scene that I'm thinking of is a scene that kind of resolves a bit of the issue in the finale of Kill Bill Volume 2, in which we don't really see Bill in all his power and glory. And this scene was a scene that was taken out, which happened earlier. And it's between when Bill takes on Michael J. White, I think his name is, and his thugs. So it's Bill and B, Uma Thurman's B, walking through this kind of quiet village, and all of a sudden this gang of thugs accosts them, and Kill Bill just wipes them out really quickly, and there's a really quick he dispatches Kill Bill, and he dispatches Michael J. White in a really cool way, where he, you know, you kind of have to look it up, and it's kind of cool. And but what was great about that scene is that we get to see Bill using his full kind of like abilities, and we see how dangerous he is and how much of a nemesis he actually will be for B when she actually faces up against him. So it would have added to the weight of her taking him on one-on-one. But it unfortunately didn't make the cut. But it's a cool scene, another cool scene you should check out if you're interested in that film.
The whole bloody affair.
Hard part's over.
And I'm going to go... See, this is just complete random, right? This is just me making my list and just randomly throwing stuff out. But another one that I really liked, because it's so unusual, and I totally, totally understand why
I
didn't
know what
the
you're
cut.
Going to say. I know what you're going to say.
Okay.
It's going be Jabba the Hutt's scene in Star Wars, isn't it?
How did you know?
In the
How did you know that I was that scene with that guy in that bearskin, whatever he was wearing, and that scene, and it's many times they try to repair that scene with, you know, from really bad CGI Jabba the Hutt to Han Solo awkwardly walking over his
stepping
tail.
Stepping on his tail.
Look, Jabba, even I get bored at sometimes. You think I had a choice?
Oh, from 2000s, Almost Famous, right?
From Cameron Crowe, writer-director of Jerry Maguire.
If you're going to be a true journalist, you cannot make friends with the rock stars. Just make us look cool.
God, it's going to get ugly, man. They're going to buy you drinks.
Don't take drugs.
They're going to fly you places for free.
It's Bowie!
You're going to meet girls.
The film by Cameron Crowe.
Okay. Yeah. That was a good film.
It's a very good film. I really liked it. It's a semi-autobiographical film. It's worth watching. It's such a cracker. So it's a semi-autographical film about Crowe and his own life, where he was, as a youngster, he was hired by Rolling Stone to go and, you know, go on tour with these bands back in the 70s. And it's about this like kid who's got this unabashed love of music, and he wants to be this rock journalist. And so he basically, in this film, he gets the opportunity to tour with a fictional up-and-coming band, you know, starring Billy Crudup, and there's Kate Hudson's in it, and Frances McDormand. And the scene I'm talking about is with Frances McDormand and the lead, Patrick Fugit, I think his name is. But scene is, Frances McDormand plays William, I think it was Billy, or William his name was, his mother. And she's a very protective parent and very active parent, and kind of shepherds everything he does. So when he proposes to her that he wants to go on tour, she is sternly opposed to it. And he sits down and he wants to make a case, a very unusual case for why he should go on this tour. And what he does is he goes over to the family record player. Now, at that same moment, she has two of her friends in the living room. They're in the family living room. She has two of her kind of like conservative friends in the room with her. Also in the room is Billy's sister's boyfriend. And Billy says, Mom, I really want to do this, and I want to play something for you, and this is going to be, this will change your mind. And what he does is he goes over to the record player and he puts on the song Stairway to Heaven. And the whole scene is them as a group sitting there listening to Stairway to Heaven. And it is fantastic. It's 8 minutes long. And it is, there's no dialogue between them. And they weren't allowed to get the rights. That's the reason the scene's not in it. But also it's 8 minutes of them just listening to Stairway to Heaven. But what happens is that it's this awkward moment. You can imagine in a room with your mam and you decide to put on your like contemporary pop band and you expect in that environment that your piece of music and is going to win them over. And you know how awkward that would actually be, and it is that awkward. And Frances McDormand is brilliant, and there's no dialogue. How she's kind of like defensively just like picking up a magazine and just kind of looking at the magazine and even looking at the lyrics. But Sandwich, she's sitting on a couch, and Sandwich between her, she's on the couch, and on the far end of the couch is one of her friends, a conservative friend. But Sandwich between them is her daughter's boyfriend, and he's all for it. And as the song is playing out, he starts playing all of the roles in the band. He's drumming away, and as it goes, as the song picks up, he gets more vigorous and more vigorous. And it is very funny. It's very good. It's very good. And, you know, it's just a class little scene. And it's just poor William's face as he goes along, as the song goes along. He's kind of just nodding to his mother going, "You see, Mom? You see?" And she's just going, "Nope." Just going, "I do not see." It is wonderful. A wonderful moment of just adolescence versus, you know, a parent. And I love it.
Which will
I love it so much.
Definitely get a copyright strike if we include it in this podcast.
That was when I watched it, because there's no, it's all Stairway to Heaven. Not a chance can I play any clip from it. Nothing. That's a good one, Kevin. Oh, it really is. Yeah, I have to watch that film again. It's been a while. Yeah, it's been a long time. And that's another one that has a director's cut. There was it came out as Untitled, and then there was another version came out a couple of years ago called The Bootleg Cut, and that might include the Stairway to Heaven song. I'm not really sure, but I think...
Do you remember in the early 2000s, they kept putting out the unrated cuts of DVDs, and it was always shite. It was like stuff where you think, this shouldn't have been in the film. This just didn't work. There's one in Step Brothers that is the heart attack scene with... where Will goes to his brother's job site to interview with, what's his name? Fucking Rob something. Rob Riggle? Rob Riggle, I think it is, yeah. With him. And he has a heart attack while he's... while he's sort of like giving him a bollocking.
Well, I definitely don't want that.
If you're going to make it through this, man, you got to have big balls. I'm talking about hairy, thick, veiny, robust balls. A big satchel, right? Chicken skin on the outside of your scrotum. And a big, thick root hanging on top of it with a big purple bulbous head on the end of it attached to it. And it's one big package glistening and sweat with a big thatch of pubic hair on top of it. It's so beautiful.
Rick. Oh. Hey, what's going on? Are you okay?
It's a Catalina wine mixer! You nail it or you're gone! Ah!
Do you want me to call someone?
God!
Yo!
Hey, Derek!
Tom, what's up?
How's it going, man?
Yeah. He gets so sort of like into it that he literally like passes out and has a heart attack. But when you're watching it, you're thinking, oh God, that is really early 2000s humor, because it is deeply, deeply problematic, where the names they're calling each other. And yeah, it's like when you look at what was the film with Paul Rudd, where they had was it a 40-year-old virgin, where they had that running joke of like, you know, I know you're gay, him and Seth Rogen would keep this takes that to an ultimate extreme, where it's like, that would not fly right now. That would get everybody cancelled.
Surprise.
He's having a heart attack.
You're having a heart attack. What are you, a doctor?
Do we need to call someone?
No.
Call your mother, maybe.
He's fine.
I'm fine. I'm on top of my game.
It's called commitment. Yeah. It's called aggressive salesmanship.
Being a salesman.
Two words you should know, motherfucker.
I think we should call an ambulance.
No. Listen, you can't fuck this up, Brennan.
Okay.
All right? It's a Catalina wine mixer.
He's unconscious.
Now I have to sell or lease 85 choppers. You good?
Hey, Derek.
Yeah.
What are you doing here, man?
Oh, I just walked in.
But yeah, oh, those unrated cuts, man, they were taking the piss with the deleted scenes.
They were just double dipping. It was just any reason to, you know, get people to potentially buy another copy of the same film. That was just all at the height of the DVD's boom. It was just another reason to sell. Slap a different font cut. We've got a different font on
it's
the title.
It's unrated,
cards.
But it's also ungraded, and it's unmixed, and it's
awful.
It hasn't been edited. Yeah.
Oh man.
There's two that we I feel like, because this is particularly like deleted scenes category, we have to mention them, even though we've brought them up on other podcasts at least once already. But it is that scene from Popstars, Never Stopping, the fuck you thing. That's one that we just got to slot it in here. It's got to go in here because it's so good.
It's the fuck off song. It's the fuck off song, Kevin.
Hey yo, this one's dedicated to all the little kids out there whose parents are always riding on. Telling you to do your homework, never letting you eat dessert, and making you go to bed before you're ready. But listen, the next time they're acting bogus, I want you to try this out. Stand up on your tippy toes, look them dead in the eye, and say, Mom, Dad, you can both fuck off.
Oh, it's so good. It is so funny, and like you said back then, I just can't believe it didn't make the film, because it is just so bloody funny, and probably cost a lot of money to stage as well. Like, you know, it's fantastic. Yeah, if you haven't seen Popstars, what's it? Popstars Never Stop. What's the full title?
Never Stopping.
I was like, Never Stop, Never Stop Popping. It is great. It is just so funny. It really is. I highly recommend it. The next scene I'm going to bring up is from one of my all-time favourite films from the 90s, and it is Jonathan Demme's...
Basic Instinct.
It's Basic Instinct, when the detectives uncross their legs and they're wearing crotchless pants.
It was when Sharon Stone kept uncrossing her legs. It was like over and back, over and back, over and back. No, Paul, this is now going too far. This is what people want. This is what they want to watch.
Well, you're in the thriller zone, and I'm going to thriller as well. It's actually
Johnny
from 1990s.
Depp.
The Silence of the Lambs. Okay, and I love The Silence of the Lambs.
You spook easily, Starling.
Not yet, sir.
He's past the others. The last cell. I'll be watching. You'll do fine.
A killer is on the loose.
Keeps them alive for 3 days. Then he shoots them, skins them, and dumps them.
A rookie FBI agent is on his trail.
And I found this class deleted scene from that film, which really, I was questioning why they cut it. And it must have been a real debating scene. The scene is, we all know what The Silence of the Lambs is. Clarice Starling, played by Jodie Foster, is hunting down a serial killer called Buffalo Bill. And she recruits the assistance of an even worse serial killer called Hannibal Lecter, played by Anthony Hopkins. So she has this series of encounters, a series of interviews with Hannibal Lecter to try and, you know, work out what's going on. And in one of the later interviews she has with Hannibal Lecter, right, as she's kind of gotten his confidence, or he's gotten her confidence.
Dr. Lecter.
There's a scene, Kevin, and it really was. It was a fascinating one. Lecter he's got his back to camera. It's all dark. You know that creepy cell he's in with the little drilled holes, air holes in the glass, like, you know? And he's got his back to camera, and he starts talking about the history of Buffalo Bill as a child.
Aunt Clarice, next time you will tell me why you ran away, won't you? Now listen carefully, because I will not repeat this. You're trying to obtain a list of males rejected by all three gender centers. Check first the ones rejected for having lied about criminal records. Look for severe childhood disturbances associated with violence. How Billy wasn't born a killer, Clarice. Oh no, he was made one through years of systematic abuse. Go to the personality tests. Study their drawings. Billy's houses will be very small, with tiny windows, no flowers, no pets, no toys, no sun. and his females will be even more crudely sketched than his males. But he will compensate with exaggerated adornments, jewelry, big breasts, and then his trees. Oh, yes, Clarice. His trees will be frightful.
And yeah. Anthony Hopkins, Hannibal Lecter, turns around to camera and he's looking straight at us down the lens, which is a device they employ so brilliantly in that film of characters looking straight down the lens to a nervous. But when he's talking about this abused child, the light kind of, a light illuminates on his face. And we see something in Hannibal Lecter's eyes that I certainly did not see in the theatrical cut. And there were tears. And Lecter was actually welling up talking about this child, this abused child. And in actual fact, it made me question. I was like going, shit, is he talking about himself right here? He's talking about, okay, I know he's talking about Buffalo Bill, but you know he's pulling on something from his own past. And that was, it was very... it was a scene that I'm sure they debated about cutting, and
because I think that if he's getting emotional, that almost flies in the face of him being a psychopath. So it's probably like, although some of the psychology of that film is a bit iffy, but
it's the suggestion of tears. It's the suggestion of. But like it's almost incongruous to what he's saying, and again, I think it's tastily done, and it was a cracker of a deleted scene. It was on its own. I was like, "Fuck it, this is, yeah." I love that film, you know, from the bottom of my heart. I think it's absolutely incredible. And the filmmaking.
When you mentioned that, now what I'm reminded of is there was a meme going around it was a viral tweet going around where. Someone said that they love the sort of direct-to-camera looks in Jonathan Demme's Silence of the Lambs. And it had, you know, Jodie Foster looking direct on the camera. It had the prison warden guy looking direct to camera. It had Hannibal Lecter looking direct to camera. And then it had the dog, little poochy dog at the end,
right.
Looking direct to camera as well as he's looking into the pit. And it made me laugh.
Well, I saw it in that film. It was always a very clever device, because they very clearly the Jonathan Demme and the rest of the filmmakers decided to try and put us in Jodie Foster's in a female detective's shoes. And in a very early scene when she's in her in the FBI headquarters, and her mentor, her ally and mentor, is talking to her, he's talking directly down the camera, which kind of is a no-go in filmmaking terms. Traditionally you're not supposed to. It's kind of crossing the line, effectively, like, you know.
It's very documentary style, isn't it?
And what it does, it makes us feel like they are talking to us. We embody Jodie Foster's shoes. So when someone's looking straight down the camera at you, it actually is, one, it's more engaging, but it's also a little bit intimidating, because someone's looking at you rather than us. If you're looking at someone in a traditional way a film would be shot, you're looking at someone who's looking off camera, let's say, to another character. But when they're looking down the lens, they're looking at you.
It's such a power move, though, to look directly into somebody's eyes when you speak to them. Like, to not, like, you know, look around the room or whatever, but to look directly into their eyes, it weirds some people out. They get very uncomfortable. But
yeah, that's why we don't have videos on here, because you just stare at me for the entire hour that we're doing this, and I just keep looking away awkwardly. Kevin, stop looking at me, stop staring at me, Kevin. You're just trying to intimidate me.
I am not going to make another joke about being naked while I do the podcast. I don't know why I keep bringing that up. It was funny once, and I keep... I'm like, oh, it'd be really funny if it's inappropriate that I'm naked while doing this. Like, move on, new material.
There's another one I really liked from the year 2000, actually. And it was from a film I also really enjoyed.
Vintage.
Good year, and it's High Fidelity.
My store is called Championship Vinyl.
I can't fire them. I hired these guys for 3 days a week, and they just started showing up every day. That was 4 years ago.
Directed by, was it Stephen Frears?
Frears.
Yeah, it was Stephen Frears, and it's adapted from Nick Hornby's book, you know, and it's
really
about
fun film.
If you
A great rom-com.
Great film. And it just a great nerd, and you know, a nerd film as well about, you know, music
a dude
nerds.
Dude's rock movie.
Oh, it's great. It kind of launched. It kind of launched Jack Black, didn't it? It really did, you know, elevate him in a
no,
big way.
No, because he'd been in. I Still Know What You Did Last Summer, and you know, that was a.
Oh, that was just a career. It put him into the stratosphere, and he was also in Mars Attacks. By the way, he was in Mars Attacks for sure. I know that. For anyone who hasn't seen High Fidelity, it's a comedy, and it's about a record store. John Cusack plays the record store owner, and he gets dumped by his girlfriend because he basically is just, you know, he's set in his ways. And he's going back. Yeah, he certainly is, yeah. And he's a music snob. And he kind of, the whole film is about him going over his previous breakups to try and figure out, like, you know, what he needs to do to win back his, you know, his girlfriend. And he's got this, in his record shop, he's got two assistants, one played by Jack Black and the other by, oh God, what's the other guy's? It's like Todd, I think it's Todd Lucy or something like that. But anyway, there's a great scene in this in which John Cusack gets a random phone call from Fridge's seller of some rare records. And he goes to the house anyway, and he opens the door of this kind of a nice house, and there standing in the doorway is Beverly D'Angelo. And we know Beverly D'Angelo from the National Lampoon's movies. She plays Clark Griswold's wife. And she goes in and she shows him to a wall full of records, right? You know, and he's just going, okay, okay. And she walks straight over, and at the bottom she pulls out this kind of like secret drawer, and it's got all these singles, you know. And John Cusack goes over, and it's like Indiana Jones in the opening scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and he's like seeing.
It's the best collection I've ever seen.
I wouldn't doubt it.
You know, I can only afford to buy just a few of these.
Give me $50 and they're all yours.
Yeah, right. These are worth at least,
I know what they're worth. 20. Give me 50 and get them out of here.
Her husband has left her for a 19-year-old, and she's in Jamaica. And he's asked her to sell off his collection. But basically, it's worth, this collection is probably worth, you know, in the tens of thousands, and she's going to sell it for $50. And but what ends up happening is John Cusack is like going, I can't take this. He's a music lover. He's a fellow music lover. I can't touch this. I can't do this. And basically, the two of them start haggling.
Let's compromise. What about 1,500? They're worth at least 10 times that.
$60.
1,300.
75.
1,100. That's my lowest offer.
And I won't take a penny over 90.
I've not seen that scene.
It's a fun little scene. Like, and again, I can see why it's cut, because it doesn't really move the central story forward. But, you know, it's kind of it's a side subplot about an estranged wife and an embittered person. Obviously, John Cusack's going through a breakup, and but he doesn't want she's breaking up with a music lover just like him, and using his music as a way to, like, it's effectively trying to close out the first floor window into the lawn below, but she wants to burn the thing he holds most precious.
You guys are snobs.
No, we're not.
No, seriously, you're totally elitist. You feel like the unappreciated scholars, so you shit on the people who know less than you.
No.
Which is everybody.
Yes.
Now, Kevin, getting rid of it. So I'm going to James Cameron, of course, right? And James Cameron is the guy who's produced the best deleted scenes of all the deleted scenes I've found. Even from going far back as Dan, Dan mentions that amazing deleted scene that was in Terminator 2 when they are performing at... they're performing surgery on Arnold Schwarzenegger's Terminator character, in which they can change his chip, change a part of his processor from read to write. And it is an amazing scene, and I don't really have to go into it in too much detail, but it's significant because it changes so much of what happens in the not only in that film, but in the rest of the franchise, because all of a sudden Arnold Schwarzenegger's Terminator character can now learn. And that is the reason why throughout the rest of that film that he seems to show more and more empathy and behave unusually. It's because there's a scene where they actually altered the function and the how his processor works.
I know now why you cry.
Yeah. It's such an impressive scene. It's a really good scene. And obviously they cut it just for time. You know, they cut it because just to keep the story moving and whatnot.
It's been in the director cut, so now people sort of who weren't around to see it in the cinemas, they're only used to it as being always in the film, because people now watch director's cuts more than they'll watch like theatrical cuts of old movies. So I think for a lot of people, that just feels like that scene's in the movie. It's always been in the movie, but it wasn't. It was a deleted scene.
Yeah.
My CPU is a neural net processor, a learning computer, but Skynet presets the switch to read only when we are sent out alone.
Doesn't want you to do too much thinking, huh?
No.
Can we reset the switch?
He even has... We can go to 1989's The Abyss. The Abyss has got a significantly different cut. It's particularly a significantly different ending. And I've always been a huge fan of The Abyss, but it was apparently a nightmare to shoot and a nightmare to make. It went over budget. People almost died left, right and centre. And what's significant about that is that
you're only getting half the film without those deleted scenes.
Oh, it's mad. There's a lot of little scenes that are add character depth and adds their little scenes where you see development of characters, relationships, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And because that film is essentially a story about a strange couple, but there's this weird, strange thing down the end of at the bottom of this trench where they're drilling. But like at the end of that film, in the director's cut, there's this huge epic moment where the aliens actually hold the entire human civilization. Yeah, with these 100-foot, they produce these 100-foot tidal waves, or maybe 1,000-foot, I don't know how, they're huge tidal waves over every major city. And the tidal waves are just standing there, waiting to crash down on the millions of people to destroy these people.
The horizon has already grown dark. People are running everywhere. It's sheer panic. Stay on me! The wave is maybe 1,000 feet high already. Getting bigger as I'm watching. Still miles out. Oh, my God.
Get out of here.
We're staying! Give it to me, then! I don't even know if I'm still broadcasting. I can't be sure. I'll just keep going as long as I can.
Get away!
1,000 to 1,000.
They literally are holding humanity on the, they've got a gun to our head.
By the balls.
And it's kind of raises, a lot of people don't like it. Now, I have to really revisit and see how it sits for me now. But I remember when I watched it, when I first watched it, I thought, Jesus, that really, things got serious there for a moment. Yeah, yeah. The stakes really got high, maybe it got too high almost. But it really is impressive, and it was it's a big shift in that story,
Yeah. The ending of Terminator 1 has, after Sarah Connor says, "You're terminated," and she kills the T-800, instead of it going straight to her in the Jeep at the gas station getting her picture taken, which becomes the picture that Kyle Reese has when he goes back in time, before that, you have Sarah getting transferred out of the factory floor into an ambulance. But while that's happening, we're seeing these two workers at the factory finding the chip from the T-800.
What's that?
Microcomputer chassis. But I never saw stuff like that anywhere.
Weird. Jap stuff, maybe.
Get it down to R&D first thing Monday morning, huh?
Good idea.
And you know that is basically setting up Cyberdyne. So the whole franchise is basically established in that deleted scene that is expanded upon in T2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And talking about endings, the ending of T2. There was a deleted scene for the end of T2 where famously the opening scene of Terminator 2 is in a playground, and Linda Hamilton's Sarah Connor is playing with her kid, and a nuclear explosion happens and wipes them all out, and it's really horrific and terrifying. They all turn into skeletons and explode and all that sort of jazz. But in a deleted scene at the very end of that film, it's set in a playground, in that same playground, but the year is 2037. 30 years
Michael
after
Jackson is
1997.
40.
Yes, she says Michael Jackson.
No, it's 1997.
In the year. No. That scene is in 2037. Go back and check. Because John Connor in that scene is an older man. Like,
oh, he's a senator.
He's got his own children.
Yeah.
August 29th, 1997 came and went. Nothing much happened. Michael Jackson turned 40. There was no judgment day. People went to work as they always do. Laughed, complained, watched TV, made love. I wanted to run through the street yelling, to grab them all and say, every day from this day on is a gift. Use it well. Instead, I got drunk. That was 30 years ago. But the dark future, which never came, still exists for me. And it always will, like the traces of a dream.
Isn't it weird, though, because he did a director's cut of that film, and he restored that scene that Dan mentioned and that we talked about, with the processing chip being taken out of his head. But he's left that scene out. So he still didn't think that scene was worthy of going into the film. And it's sort of good that he didn't put it back in, because it would have, well, actually, maybe he should have put it back in, because it would have stopped that franchise from continuing.
there you go. It would have said, everything's fine. Yeah. Don't worry. They would have just created alternative timelines, no matter how many happy endings you stick in it. They would just go, in actual fact, no. In the background, there would be just lights.
We got to go back to the future again. Lightnings.
Yeah, here we go. All of a sudden, do a crossover with Back to the Future. Doc Brown and Arnie's Terminator. Just, you're dominated, Doc Brown. Anyway.
Don't give them ideas.
Yeah. But for my best deleted
I wonder
scene,
what it could be.
Bits.
I have no idea. This is really shocking.
Well, it's Avatar, right? And it's the sex scene in Avatar that they cut, where they join tails, and it's really explicit. And no, it's not Avatar. Even though I do have an extended sex scene in Avatar. No, of course. Well, as I'm driving this James Cameron bus into the Golden Temple of Best Bits, I, of course, have to come to one of my favourite films. And it's from, it's a sequel to a film that Kevin's already mentioned. And, of course, it's 1986's Aliens.
Movement.
Talk to me, Hudson.
I got signals. I got readings in front and behind.
There's nothing back here.
Look, I'm telling you, there's something moving and it ain't us.
Get them out of there.
Wow, this is brand new information.
Yeah, who could have guessed, you know?
When you mentioned this in the group chat and you said, how do people feel about the deleted scene to Aliens? I just went straight in there going, like, I don't like the director's cut of Aliens. So this is the first time where I approve your choice to go with this pick, but I feel that the director's cut of Aliens is inferior to the theatrical cut. But explain yourself, Will. Why do you love this director's cut and these deleted scenes in particular?
Oh, let me wax lyrical about me and my love affair with the director's cut of Aliens. I love it. I love it for all of the extended bits. I love it for the bit where we get to see more of Hadley's Hope at the beginning. We get to see Newt's parents out and them encountering the alien spaceship we saw in Alien, and the dad getting the facehugger on his face. I loved seeing Hadley's Hope before it got infested with aliens and you see kids going around in their big wheels like Danny and, in The Shining. I love the tension and suspense of the scene with the sentry guns in the corridors.
That's
so
a good moment. I like that.
It's fantastic. It's fantastic. But my favorite deleted scene that has been reinstated in the director's cut, and I know it's a scene that you obviously don't like, but I do, and it's the scene early on in the first act after Ellen Ripley, played by Sigourney Weaver, has woken up from, she's survived the events of the first film, obviously, and she's woken up, rescue pod or rescue shuttle that's just been launched out into space, and she's just been traveling through space and has been randomly picked up 57 years later, and she doesn't know, she's been in hypersleep the entire time. So when she wakes up, it's just they gradually break the news to her that you've been asleep for, is it, I think it's 57 years.
Yeah, it's 57
and the scene
years.
The scene is where she's sitting down, she's still in that kind of like safe space on this space station, but it's the first time in the only scene in the entire Alien franchise where we see trees and we see nature, you know, that's not trying to kill her. And you think, oh, she's in a park, and then the camera kind of moves and you realize it's an artificial projection on a wall and switches off. And the scene that I love is a scene where Burke, who is a company man and is kind of really friendly, but as an actual fact, a real slime ball and smarmy, comes into Ellen Ripley with
a
file.
Okay guy.
And he's a fucking jerk. And he basically is delivering information to her about her daughter.
Amanda Ripley McLaren, married name, I guess, age 66. And that was at the time of her death, which was 2 years ago. I'm real sorry.
Amy.
She was cremated and interred at Westlake Repository, Little Chute, Wisconsin. No children.
I promised her that I'd be home for her birthday. Her 11th birthday.
And I think this scene is so important for this film.
Well, Sigourney Weaver would agree with you. She was really disappointed that this was cut. She based her entire performance on this scene. And she was nominated for an Oscar for it. But yeah, she was. She complained about it. When the scene was cut, she felt like, well, everything that I informed my character on was in this moment and it was taken out, and she felt that her performance lost something because of that. But she's wrong.
No, I agree with her, Kevin. I agree with the fact that, because I can relate to her, what's going on with her. She's after coming out of hypersleep after 57 years and she has a family, and her first
lockdown
instinct
has been very hard.
But I feel I love it because, Jesus Christ, her instinct, of course, is to find out what her family, where her family is and what's happened to everyone at home. That's just gone. And in the original theatrical cut, that's never really addressed. It's just like, here you are, Ripley. Go back out there, Ripley. And it's never addressed, right? And I feel that's a bit BS-y. Like, you know, so she learns that her 11-year-old daughter, who was 11 when she left, died a 66-year-old woman, and she never got to see her. She never got to go back for her 11th birthday or whatever it was. And it's devastating. Mm. And that, for me, is so important for her motivation for the rest of that film, for her to go back. It's almost a suicide mission for her, you know? It's almost like, she's got no other, she's got, what else has she got to live for? And they coerce her and they push her. I know she's got the nightmares, and it's the PTSD is coming back, you know, haunting her. But the fact that she's lost everyone and everything is so important for her motivation. And I just think it's a really well played scene between the two of them, Paul Reiser on one side and Sigourney Weaver on the other.
But you know what I think is that the movie works without that, and it actually feels like somebody who's got nothing gains something by going back, versus in the director's cut, somebody who lost something replaces something by going back. And it's the replacement of her daughter that I find just a little bit, I think it's like a little too on the nose. And when you get to the moment where it's like, mommy, she says at the end, the fact that both of them have sort of just gotten over the fact that, oh, my mom's dead, so you're my mom, and my child's dead, so you're my daughter. It doesn't feel as beautiful to me as two sort of people who had nothing coming together, rather than two people replacing something they've lost with each other. I just prefer it without her being a grieving mother, and rather just somebody who's got nothing else in her life now. It's all gone. So it just feels like a hat on a hat. That's my take.
And
this is the first time we've ever disagreed on the podcast.
No, but it's okay to be wrong. It's absolutely fine. And
I'm used to it.
You're totally tied to it. Well, no, this is, and it's this complete look at, you know, and that's what's great about this is everyone can have their own reading on it. And
well, you've got like James Cameron or Sigourney Weaver in your camp, so you know, you've got me beat.
Yeah, but like I think it's a film that we both really, really appreciate. It's one of my favorite films. I absolutely adore this film, and it is, you know, in my top four favorite films of all time. I love it. I love the tightness of it. I love the
even
energy.
With those,
and again,
extended scenes though, because it's like it adds about 25 minutes onto it, and I really feel those 25 minutes.
I'm the opposite. I don't feel it at all. It's like, for me, it's like, I don't feel the weight of those scenes. I'm always invested. I'm always engaged in every scene. And,
what did Cameron, called it? It was like 20 more miles of bad road or something like that.
20 miles of bad road. That's exactly what it's, this film is, 20 miles of bad road. And I think, you know, for me, no, it's another, like I say, okay, I'm not a horror guy, but Jesus, I love, like, you know, I have some horror films that I absolutely, Aliens is a horror film. It's an action horror film, isn't it?
Action horror, yeah, I would say so. It depends on what your threshold is. I find the first one a lot scarier, but I find it more adrenalizing. I saw Aliens in the cinema. And, well, I saw the two of them. I saw Alien and Aliens in the cinema and sort of, what do they call it? Like a repertory screening where they bring out old classics and you can go along and watch them. And, there's a big jump in the visual quality between Aliens and Alien. But Aliens is such a fucking kick-ass action film that you can't... You can't deny the fact that it's such a fun movie. Aside from anything else, it's so I put it in best girl fights in the fight scenes episode, because you know, even though it is a puppet and a puppet fighting each other, that is such a kick ass action film. So I love Aliens as well, but
yeah. There's one other there's a deleted scene I found that's a really rare deleted scene actually. And it's not in any cut. And it's a scene right near the end when she's basically strapped those two guns together, the flamethrower and the pulse rifle. And she's going for Newt. And she's got she's kind of following the tracker, you know. And just as she's about to discover the discarded watch that Newt was supposed to be wearing, she encounters Burke, Paul Reiser's slimy character, who we earlier saw being taken by aliens, but she encounters him as he's been cocooned in the wall.
Help me. Help me. Oh, God. It's inside. Oh. God.
Oh, that would have been a cool, creepy sequence. yeah.
It's really, it actually is really, the performance is great. And what she does, she doesn't even share a word with him. All she does is she gives him a hand grenade. It's not because it wasn't in any of the cuts. It's kind of, I found it on YouTube. It's now with the, we found it recently. But I can see why it was cut. It's a very well performed. It works, and it's kind of like an almost.
It does make Ripley seem a little too cold, though, doesn't it? Where you think, yes, he got everybody killed, but I'm glad they cut that.
His performance sells the fact that he is having the most gruesome death, or he can when he says that word, I can feel it inside me. That's really kind of horrific. But yuck. I think why they removed it is because it literally just paused her. It was so close to her finding the queen that it just was a pit stop just before we got to that. You know, in the latter part of your film, you really have to be tight. You know, you really have to, you know, you don't have much time, and you have to keep the momentum going forward as fast as you can.
It's also almost beat for beat the first film, because like the first film, she's going back to rescue the cat, and in the second one, she's going back to rescue the kid, and it plays out almost the same way, except that rather than her having an encounter with the alien and getting into an astronaut suit. She has a space suit. Jesus, you can tell it's late and I'm tired. I can't even think of words. In the sequel, she gets into a mech suit and she faces off against the queen. But Cameron sort of replicated the beats of Alien, but just took them up another level at every stage. So he knew what worked and he stuck with it.
Is this an apocryphal story when he went into pitch for the sequel to Alien? He wrote Alien, an S, and then just drew two lines through the S to indicate dollar signs. It's just aliens.
I have never been in a studio office that had a chalkboard, so I don't. I think he might be sort of like he might be making that up, but maybe it was a fucking whiteboard. Who knows? But that's a brilliant pick, and I am really pleased you picked that for another reason. Because we get to do an audio commentary on it.
Yes! I would say it cynically, I could say, oh, maybe that was motivation. But no, I'm so glad I got to talk about this film. I'm so glad, because it is one of my, Aliens is one of my favourite films. And I love it, and I'm so glad it's here. And I truly believe that those deleted scenes are amazing and make the film so much better. And I disagree. Deleted scene. And it's okay. It's okay, Kevin, to be wrong. And it's fine. I don't mind it one little bit. We'll agree to disagree.
Well, that's great. That's just fucking great, man. Now what the fuck are we supposed to do? We're some real pretty shit now, man.
You finished.
So that was my best deleted scene.
Also, Apocalypse Now with the French Quarter sequence. That's really good as well. Watch that.
I'll disagree with you there now.
Okay, so now you got to spin the wheel for me.
Oh, God, Kevin. Right. Are you looking forward to this?
Yes.
Okay.
Because I've listened to so many episodes back, and it's always like when the wheel comes up and they say, and we say, third pushing ourselves. It's like, oh no, I hate this. I don't want to do it.
What are we doing?
No. And I thought, we're being very negative.
Why are you doing this to me?
We don't like we our love own this. Format. Yeah, I cannot wait.
We love this.
Hit me. Whatever it is, I am ready.
Okay,
spin
Kevin.
That
I am
fucking
now
wheel,
up
baby.
The spinning wheel, and we are going to spin the shit out of this. Here we go. And spin. It's going around in a circle. And look at him here. It's quite heavy. It's big. It's bouncing around. It's spinning. And Kevin, your topic for next week is best monologue scene.
Okay. I don't know what to say to that.
Well, you should wax lyrical.
Jaws, we've already done Jaws, so the Indianapolis speech cannot be used. Best monologue scene, best monologue scene. Okay, there's Network.
Well,
I'm going to have to think.
Okay, I'm actually...
I'm mad as hell anyway, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Well, listen, you know, I think obviously you can go the route of Tarantino. Like, he likes to, you know...
Okay, don't give it away. Don't give it away.
I'm not going to say anything, but, you know, I could say that one. I'm sure there's stuff in Police Academy. I'm sure there's some good monologues in there.
Holy shit, is there? Okay.
No, I'm just trying to steer the audience away. I love to rewatch them. I used to love those back in the day. I don't know how they hold up, but oh my
I would
god,
say poorly.
That was high art for me.
Oh god. Okay, so
Kevin,
where can people find you, Will?
Scene. People can find me on Twitter under Willem's Film, WILLUMSFILLUM. Kevin, where can people find you and our Twitter feed?
They can also find me on Twitter at Kevin Lee Han, KevinLehane. And also Best Bits Pod, we're on there as well. Please follow us, please give us 5 stars, and we'll be back next week.
Oh,
see
yeah.
ya.
Right. Cheers, thanks very much, bye.
The Best Bits Podcast is produced by Will and Kevin.
All audio clips and music heard in this episode is the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
If you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, subscribe, rate, review, all that good stuff.
If you have any notes, comments, scene suggestions, or just want to get in touch with us, email us at bestbitspodcast@gmail.com.
And here is a clip from the lad's latest Mini Bits bonus show. The full episode, plus 100 more, are available on their Patreon.
Mini Bits.
Another new episode.
Kevin, how are you?
Hi, honey. How are you?
Oh, you know, I've got this. I've got my corns sorted out. I went to the chiropodist the other day, and she
Your
said,
"Corn,
my corns. Did you ever get corns?
No.
Did you know what a corn is?
Yeah, it's a bunion on your foot, isn't it?
Yeah, like in between your toes, stuff like that.
Do you not wear any shoes like around the house? You walk
no,
barefoot.
I wear no. It's the opposite.
GA shorts.
It's the opposite. I wear incredibly tight shoes. Like those Chinese women who get their feet bound, who had their feet bound, like, you know, before the turn of this last century. And so they had incredible corns and bunions. This is a great opener for a Mini Bits episode where we get people disgusted.
Squally, it's episode 73 of the Mini Bits. I'm Kevin, you're Will. This is our Patreon podcast. Thank you to all our lovely patrons. Yeah. A few of you have jumped in recently. I don't know what we said. We try to goad people into joining up every single episode, and then every so often it's like a lot of people join because of one specific episode, and I'm like, how did we say on that episode that's different to the other 270 episodes?
Maybe it didn't sound as desperate. Maybe we said don't join. Reverse psychology, that's how we should do it. Reverse psychology, don't join up to our patron. Don't
Cancel. You don't everybody cancel.
You don't deserve to be in this group. We don't want you. We don't like
don't
the look
need
of you.
We don't need anybody.
It's just us. It's absolutely just us. Hey, should we tell you, we did, I don't know, maybe we shouldn't say it on mic, especially so early. We did an interview with the Irish Examiner last Friday.
We did.
Yeah.
And
how do you think I did?
I think you did all right. Like, you didn't interrupt me once, so I was delighted with how I came across. But, you know, there's no sort of time limit on this. We don't know when it's going to get posted. One of our friends was saying, Kathy at the cinema was saying that their interview with, did they do the Examiner as well? It was 6 months before it posted.
And the Guardian, I'm pretty sure. They were profiled in the Guardian as well.
Yeah, but we don't do any really promotion. Like, we don't do anything.
Well, this is our first time getting any sort of like proper coverage, which is going to be mad. So listen to all you listeners who have found us before we explode.
You're an OG. Bust. You're an OG listener before Kevin starts getting gold chains from all his Patreon dash.
I think I'm more of a silver than a gold. I think my undertones suit more silver. But yeah.
I just want to die.
Those are my Prince Albert.
Your hat?
Yeah.
I want one of those diamond studs in my tooth. That's all I want. So I can go bing whenever I'm on a call.
Oh, yeah.
Bing.
I usually just, you know, wink and that glints.
Yeah.
Like a starlight twinkle.
Speaking of which, I interrupted you. What did you want to speak of? Which?
Start the timer.
Oh! I forgot.
You may as well.
Start the timer.
All these lucky losers are listening in and they're wondering, what are we going to be talking about? But we have to start talking about them after.
Yeah.
We say goodbye. But look, I wanted to talk to you about, well, you've seen a few things. You've seen the new Godzilla film.
Yes.
I've seen the first Omen. I saw Scoop as well.
We're looking Netflix forward to watching this. We already see, okay.
Okay. I'll save my thoughts. And what else did I see? I made notes, but sure, it doesn't really matter.
I think I saw it.
And I was going to go through all the summer releases and see what takes your fancy.
Okay. I'm looking forward because I don't actually know what's on the horizon. So
the Joker 2 trailer came out today.
I saw it. Yes, I watched that.
Mm-hmm. It reminded me of Chicago.
Yeah, it's kind of like you see it's all very much in the mind's eye. They're calling it a jukebox musical. Am I right in saying that?
I think you're right in saying that.
So, look, hey, listen, I actually, what it did remind me of was that I want to rewatch The Joker because I saw it in the cinema and I thought it was fine. It was kind of a bold new direction.
I'm just going to go back and watch the episodes from the Batman 66 show, the Joker episodes.
Oh, yeah, that's going
to
be...
Just to fill me in, like, on the lore. You know, get up to speed.
Get you right up to speed. And you'll be there going, where are all the guys in the purple suits with the masks? When are they going to show up? And like,
it's a bit of a weird time, though, where we have the Penguin TV show with Colin Farrell coming out, which is a totally different canon version of the Penguin. Then you have this offshoot of Joker, which is its own universe entirely.
Mm.
And then you have the old Batman films that you can watch.
Right.
And, I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's just, I don't know. I'm kind There's of so many IP.
But like,
it's just everywhere.
What's happened is the comic book world has very much entered the film world. It's where you could have different runs, totally different runs of a character by
it's
different
insane.
Authors. And there would be totally different riffs on it and stuff. Oh, this is
insane.
The thing. Kevin, so I'm only catching up on this. You mentioned it to me on a podcast. Was it on one of those show?
It was the last mini bits. Yeah,
you said everyone's describing stuff as insane recently.
And have you started noticing it though?
Only with people trying to rise you. That's the only place where I've noticed people on Discord are trying to rise you.
Oh my god! Oh my god! I could start posting now, like tweets, comments, TikToks. Articles, anything. Insane is everywhere. This is insane. That's insane. It's insane. There was a festival just going on about this insane lineup. I was like, oh, it's a mentally ill lineup. Okay. it's everywhere. And the other thing that's also bothering me lately?
Wow.
And this has been bothering me for years and years and years. It used to be that everyone used to misspell definitely. They'd go defiantly.
Okay.
Oh, it's defiantly whatever. It would just, there are morons. But no. I just keep noticing everyone keeps spelling a lot as one word, A-L-O-T, a lot. Where have they gotten into their heads that a lot is one word? It's the same way that people will write every time as one word.
What's the one that you've pulled me up on a few times and I can't get it right? Compliment.
Compliment.
I can't, but I can't get it right. It's like the
I. You can, because I told you the other day.
Yeah, and I went searching for it and I couldn't find it because I had to use it.
If there's an I in compliment, it's I'm paying you a compliment.
That's a good way to remember it. Okay, good. And then compliment.
I wrote that to you.
But you did, and I went to try and find it because I found myself writing the word compliment. And I went, shit, Kevin.
But you gave me a thumbs up, which meant in my world that, yeah, I read that. Thanks.
But I did, right? I'm talking about a couple of days later when I was faced with the exact same hurdle of writing the word compliment. I went, okay, what did Kevin say again about compliment? There's an I and the E. What did he say? So I went searching for it and I found it, I think. And I went, oh, the eye is paying me a compliment, or I'm giving you
it's
a compliment.
It's insane how little you can retain information. It's insane.
Come here, let's start talking about what we watched. Come on.
Did you start the timer?
Yeah, it's gone. It's ticking. It's ticking down. The world's going to explode.
You know, I have to put in the sound effect. I have to line up all my sound effects.
When you said start the timer,
I have a whole fucking, I have a whole soundboard. Okay. Jesus Christ, where's my fucking,
what?
Where's my ding dang ding?
Here we go. The timer has started. There we go.
There we go. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Right.